Welcome to Short Happy Life, a weekly half-hour reading of a short story. This evening, during CKDU's first annual funding drive, we present a collection of myths and folk tales. First, Ovid's Myth of Actaeon.
Indeed, no one must ever wait for the last day of a man's life, and call no one happy until he is dead and buried. Amid so much prosperity, it was one of his grandsons, Actaeon, who first brought distress to Cadmus, when antlers, foreign to his human shape, sprouted from the youth's forehead, and his hounds gorged themselves on their master's blood. But calm reflection will show that destiny was to blame for Actaeon's misfortunes, not any guilt on his own part, for there is nothing sinful in losing one's way. The scene of this event was a mountain, where the ground was stained with the bloodshed of wild beasts of many kinds. The heat of midday had shortened the shadows, and the sun was midway between his eastern and his western goal, when the young Actaeon called to his comrades, as they roamed the lonely thickets, saying in a gentle tone, "My friends, our nets and swords are dripping with the blood from the beasts we've taken. We have had enough success for one day. When tomorrow's dawn, riding in her saffron car, brings us another day, we shall return to our chosen task. But now the sun is at its highest, halfway on its course, cracking open the fields with its heat. For the present, then, put an end to your hunting, and gather in your knotted nets." The men did as he suggested, and stopped for a time their strenuous activities. There was a valley thickly overgrown with pitch pine and with sharp-needled cypress trees. It was called Gargaphy, and was sacred to Diana, the goddess of the hunt. Far in its depths lay a woodland cave, which no hand of man had wrought, but nature by her own devices had imitated art. She had carved a natural arch from the living stone and the soft tufa rocks. On the right hand was a murmuring spring of clear water, spreading out into a wide pool with grassy banks. Here the goddess, when she was tired with hunting in the woods, used to bathe her fastidious limbs in the pure water. When she entered the grotto, she handed her javelin to one of the nymphs, who acted as her armor-bearer, along with her quiver and her bow, unstrung. Another nymph received her cloak and hung it across her arm, while two more took off her sandals. Yet another attendant, more skilled than the rest, Crocale, the daughter of Ismenus, gathered up the tresses which lay scattered on the goddess's shoulders, and bound them into a knot, though her own hair hung loose. Nephele, Hyale, Rannus, Seca, and Phile drew up the water in capacious jars, and poured it over their mistress. Now while Diana was bathing there in her stream, as usual, the grandson of Cadmus, who had for the present abandoned his hunting, came wandering with hesitant steps through this wood which he had never before seen. He reached the grove, so were the fates directing him, and entered the cave, which was moist with spray. The nymphs, discovered in their nakedness, beat their breasts at the sight of a man, and filled all the grove with their sudden outcry. Crowding around Diana, they sheltered her with their own bodies, but the goddess was taller than they, head and shoulders above them all. When she was caught unclad, a blush mantled her cheeks, as bright as when clouds reflect the sun's rays, as bright as rosy dawn. Though hidden by her comrades, who gathered closely round her, she stood turned aside, looking back over her shoulder. She wished she had her arrows ready to hand. Instead, she caught up a handful of the water which she did have, and threw it in the young man's face. As she sprinkled his hair with the vengeful drops, she also spoke these words, ominous of coming disaster. "Now, if you can, you may tell how you saw me when I was undressed." She uttered no more threats, but made the horns of a long-lived stag sprout where she had scattered water on his brow. She lengthened his neck, brought the tips of his ears to a point, changed his hands to feet, his arms to long legs, and covered his body with a dappled skin. Then she put panic, fear, in his heart as well. The hero fled, and even as he ran, marveled to find himself so swift. When he glimpsed his face and his horns reflected in the water, he tried to say, "Alas," but no words came. He groaned. That was all the voice he had, and tears ran down his changed cheeks. Only his mind remained the same as before. What was he to do? Return home to the royal palace or hide in the woods? He was ashamed to do the first, afraid to do the second. As he hesitated, his hounds caught sight of him. Melampus and the wise Icnobates were the first to give tongue, Icnobates of the Cretan breed, and Melampus of the Spartan. Then the others rushed to the chase, swifter than the wind, Pamphagus and Dorceus and Oribasus, all Arcadians, and strong Nebrophonus, Fierce Theron, and Laylaps too. Terraclaps, the swift runner, was there, and keen-scented Agre, Hyalas, who had lately been gored by a wild boar, Nape, offspring of a wolf, Poaminus, the shepherd dog, Harpaia, with her two pups, Laden from Sicyon, slender-flanked, Andromus and Canisae, Stichte and Tagris, Alce, white-coated Lucan, and black-haired Asbolus. With them was Lacon, a dog of outstanding strength, and Aelo, the stout runner. Thos and swift Lysisi, with her brother Cyprius, Harpalus, who had a white spot in the middle of his black forehead, and Melanaeus and Shaggy Lacne, Libros and Agrotus, both crossbred of a Cretan mother and a Spartan father, shrill-barking Hylactor, and others whom it would take a long time to name. The pack, eager for its prey, swept over the rocks and crags, over unapproachable cliffs, through places where the going was difficult, and where there was no way at all. Actaeon fled, where he had himself so often pursued his quarry, fled, alas, before his own faithful hounds. He longed to cry out, "I am Actaeon, don't you know your own master?" But the words he wanted to utter would not come. The air echoed with barking. First Melanchates fastened his teeth in his master's back, then Theridamas and Orestrophus clung to his shoulders. They had been slow to begin the chase, but it outstripped the others by taking a shortcut over the mountains. While they held their master down, the rest of the pack gathered and sank their teeth into his body, till there was no place left for tearing. Actaeon groaned, uttering a sound which, though not human, was yet such as no stag could produce. The ridges he knew so well were filled with his mournful cries. Falling to his knees, like a suppliant in prayer, he silently swayed his head this way and that, as if stretching out beseeching arms. But his friends, not knowing what they did, urged on the ravening mob with their usual encouragements, and looked round for Actaeon, shouted for Actaeon, as if he were not there, each trying to call louder than the other. They lamented that their leader was absent, and that his slowness prevented him from seeing the booty chance had offered. Actaeon turned his head at the sound of his name. Well might he wish to be absent, but he was all too surely present. Well might he wish to see and not to feel the cruel deeds of his hounds. They surrounded him on every side, fastening their jaws on his body, and tore to pieces the seeming stag, which was in fact their master. Only when he had been dispatched by wounds innumerable, so men say, was the anger of Diana, the quiver-bearing goddess, appeased. When the story was told, opinions were divided. Some thought that the goddess had been too cruel, others praised her, and declared her act in keeping with her strict chastity. Both sides could justify their views. A Russian folktale, The Magic Swan Geese. An old man lived with his old wife. They had a daughter and a little son. "Daughter, daughter," said the mother, "we're going to work. We shall bring you back a bun, sew you a dress, and buy you a handkerchief. Be careful, watch over your little brother. Do not leave the house." The parents went away, and the daughter forgot what they had told her. She put her brother on the grass beneath the window, ran out into the street, and became absorbed in games. Some magic swan geese came, seized the little boy, and carried him off on their wings. The girl came back and found her brother gone. She gasped and rushed to look in every corner, but could not find him. She called him, wept, and lamented that her father and mother would scold her severely. Still her little brother did not answer. She ran into the open field. The swan geese flashed in the distance and vanished behind a dark forest. The swan geese had long had a bad reputation. They had done a great deal of damage and stolen many little children. The girl guessed that they had carried off her brother and rushed after them. She ran and ran and saw a stove. "Stove, stove, tell me, whither have the geese flown? If you eat my cake of rye, I will tell you. Oh, in my father's house we don't even eat cakes of wheat." The stove did not tell her. She ran further and saw an apple tree. "Apple tree, apple tree, tell me, whither have the geese flown? If you eat one of my wild apples, I will tell you." "Oh, in my father's house we don't even eat sweet apples." She ran farther and saw a river of milk with shores of pudding. "River of milk, shores of pudding, whither have the geese flown? If you eat of my simple pudding with milk, I will tell you." "Oh, in my father's house we don't even eat cream." She would have run in the fields and wandered in the woods for a long time if she had not luckily met a hedgehog. She wanted to nudge him, but was afraid that he would prick her, and she asked, "Hedgehog, hedgehog, have you not seen whither the geese have flown?" "Thither," he said, and showed her. She ran and saw a little hut that stood on chicken legs and turned round and round. In the little hut lay Baba Yaga with veined snout and clay legs, and the little brother was sitting on a bench, playing with golden apples. His sister saw him, crept near him, seized him, and carried him away. But the geese flew after her. If the robbers overtook her, where would she hide? There flowed the river of milk with shores of pudding. "Little Mother River, hide me," she begged, "if you eat my pudding." There was nothing to be done. She ate it, and the river hid her beneath the shore, and the geese flew by. She went out, said thank you, and ran on, carrying her brother. And the geese turned back and flew toward her. What could she do in this trouble? There was the apple tree. "Apple tree, apple tree, little mother, hide me," she begged. "If you eat my wild apple," she ate it quickly. The apple tree covered her with branches and leaves. The geese flew by. She went out again and ran on with her brother. The geese saw her and flew after her. They came quite close. They began to strike her with their wings. At any moment they would tear her brother from her hands. Luckily, there was the stove in her path. "Madam Stove, hide me," she begged, "if you eat my cake of rye." The girl quickly stuck the cake in her mouth, went into the stove, and sat there. The geese whirred and whirred, quacked and quacked, and finally flew away without recovering their prey. And the girl ran home, and it was a good thing that she came when she did, for soon afterward her mother and father arrived. An African myth: why tortoise's shell is not smooth. Low voices, broken now and then by singing, reached Okonkwo from his wife's hut as each woman and her children told folk stories. Ekwefi and her daughter Enzinma sat on a mat on the floor. It was Ekwefi's turn to tell a story. "Once upon a time," she began, "all the birds were invited to a feast in the sky. They were very happy and began to prepare themselves for the great day. They painted their bodies with red camwood and drew beautiful patterns on them with uli. Tortoise saw all these preparations and soon discovered what it all meant. Nothing that happened in the world of the animals ever escaped his notice. He was full of cunning. As soon as he heard of the great feast in the sky, his throat began to itch at the very thought. There was a famine in those days, and Tortoise had not eaten a good meal for 2 moons. His body rattled like a piece of dry stick in his empty shell. So he began to plan how he would go to the sky. But he had no wings," said Enzinma. "Be patient," said her mother. "That is the story. Tortoise had no wings, but he went to the birds and asked to be allowed to go with them." "We know you too well," said the birds when they had heard them. "You are full of cunning, and you are ungrateful. If we allow you to come with us, you will soon begin your mischief." "You do not know me," said Tortoise. "I am a changed man. I have learned that a man who makes trouble for others is also making it for himself." Tortoise had a sweet tongue, and within a short time all the birds agreed that he was a changed man, and they each gave him a feather, with which he made 2 wings. At last the great day came, and Tortoise was the first to arrive at the meeting place. When all the birds had gathered together, they set off in a body. Tortoise was very happy and voluble as he flew among the birds, and he was soon chosen as the man to speak for the party because he was a great orator. "There is one thing important which we must not forget," he said as they flew on their way. "When people are invited to a great feast like this, they take new names for the occasion. Our hosts in the sky will expect us to honor this age-old custom." None of the birds had heard of this custom, but they knew that Tortoise, in spite of his failings in other directions, was a widely traveled man who knew the customs of different peoples. And so they each took a new name. When they had all taken, Tortoise also took one. He was to be called All of You. At last the party arrived in the sky, and their hosts were very happy to see them. Tortoise stood up in his many-colored plumage and thanked them for their invitation. His speech was so eloquent that all the birds were glad they had brought him, and nodded their heads in approval of all he said. Their hosts took him as the king of the birds, especially as he looked somewhat different from the others. After kola nuts had been presented and eaten, the people of the sky set before their guests the most delectable dishes tortoise had ever seen or dreamed of. The soup was brought out hot from the fire and in the very pot in which it had been cooked. It was full of meat and fish. Tortoise began to sniff aloud. There was pounded yam and also yam pottage cooked with palm oil and fresh fish. There were also pots of palm wine. When everything had been set before the guests, one of the people of the sky came forward and tasted a little from each pot. He then invited the birds to eat. But Tortoise jumped to his feet and asked, "For whom have you prepared this feast?" "For all of you," replied the man. Tortoise turned to the birds and said, "You remember that my name is All of You. The custom here is to serve the spokesman first and the others later. They will serve you when I have eaten." He began to eat, and the birds grumbled angrily. The people of the sky thought it must be their custom to leave all the food for their king. And so Tortoise ate the best part of the food and then drank two pots of palm wine, so that he was full of food and drink and his body filled out in his shell. The birds gathered round to eat what was left and to peck at the bones he had thrown all about the floor. Some of them were too angry to eat. They chose to fly home on an empty stomach. But before they left, each took back the feather he had lent to Tortoise. And there he stood in his hard shell full of food and wine, but without any wings to fly home. He asked the birds to take a message for his wife, but they all refused. In the end, Parrot, who had felt more angry than the others, suddenly changed his mind and agreed to take the message. "Tell my wife," said Tortoise, "to bring out all the soft things in my house and cover the compound with them so that I can jump down from the sky without very great danger." Parrot promised to deliver the message and then flew away. But when he reached Tortoise's house, he told his wife to bring out all the hard things in the house. And so she brought out her husband's hoes, machetes, spears, guns, and even his cannons. Tortoise looked down from the sky and saw his wife bringing things out, but it was too far to see what they were. When all seemed ready, he let himself go. He fell and fell and fell, until he began to fear he would never stop falling. Then, like the sound of his cannon, he crashed on the compound. "Did he die?" said Enzinma. "No," replied Ekwefi. "His shell broke into pieces, but there was a great medicine man in the neighborhood. Tortoise's wife sent for him, and he gathered up all the bits of shell and stuck them together. That is why Tortoise's shell is not smooth." Little Red Cap by the Brothers Grimm. There was once a sweet little maid, much beloved by everyone, but most of all by her grandmother, who never knew how to make enough of her. Once she sent her a little cap of red velvet, and as it was very becoming to her, and she never wore anything else, people called her Little Red Cap. One day her mother said to her, "Come, Little Red Cap, here are some cakes and a flask of wine for you to take to your grandmother. She is weak and ill, and they will do her good. Make haste and start before it grows hot, and walk properly and nicely, and don't run, or you might fall and break the flask of wine, and there'll be none left for your grandmother. When you go into her room, don't forget to say good morning, instead of staring about you." "I will be sure to take care," said Little Red Cap to her mother, and gave her hand upon it. Now the grandmother lived away in the wood, half an hour's walk from the village, and when Little Red Cap had reached the wood, she met the wolf. But as she did not know what a bad sort of animal he was, she did not feel frightened. "Good day, Little Red Cap," said he. "Thank you kindly, Wolf," answered she. "Where are you going so early, Little Red Cap?" "To my grandmother's." "What are you carrying under your apron?" "Cakes and wine. We baked yesterday, and my grandmother is very ill and weak, so they will do her good and strengthen her." "Where does your grandmother live, Little Red Cap?" "A quarter of an hour's walk from here. Her house stands beneath the three oak trees, and you may know it by the hazel bushes," said Little Red Cap. The wolf thought to himself, "That tender young thing would be a delicious morsel, and it would taste better than the old one. I must manage somehow to get both of them." Then he walked by Little Red Cap a little while, and said, "Little Red Cap, just look at the pretty flowers that are growing all round you, and I don't think you are listening to the song of the birds. You are posting along just as if you were going to school, and it is so delightful out here in the wood." Little Red Cap glanced round her, and when she saw the sunbeams darting here and there through the trees, and lovely flowers everywhere, she thought to herself, "If I were to take a fresh nosegay to my grandmother, she would be very pleased, and it is so early in the day that I shall reach her in plenty of time." And so she ran about in the wood, looking for flowers. And as she picked one, she saw a still prettier one farther on, and so she went farther and farther into the wood. But the wolf went straight to the grandmother's house and knocked on the door. "Who is there?" cried the grandmother. "Little Red Cap," he answered, "and I have brought you some cake and wine. Please open the door." "Lift the latch," cried the grandmother. "I'm too feeble to get up." So the wolf lifted the latch, and the door flew open, and he fell on the grandmother and ate her up without saying one word. Then he drew on her clothes, put on her cap, lay down in her bed, and drew the curtains. Little Red Cap was all this time running about among the flowers, and when she had gathered as many as she could hold, she remembered her grandmother, and set off to go to her. She was surprised to find the door standing open, and when she came inside she felt very strange, and thought to herself, "Oh dear, how uncomfortable I feel, and I was so glad this morning to go to my grandmother." And when she said, "Good morning," there was no answer. Then she went up to the bed and drew back the curtains. There lay the grandmother, with her cap pulled over her eyes, so that she looked very odd. "Oh, grandmother, what large ears you have got! The better to hear with." "Oh, grandmother, what great eyes you have got! The better to see with." "Oh, grandmother, what large hands you've got! The better to take hold of you with. But, grandmother, what a terrible large mouth you've got! The better to devour you." And no sooner had the wolf said it than he made one bound from the bed and swallowed up poor little Red Cap. Then the wolf, having satisfied his hunger, lay down again in the bed, went to sleep, and began to snore loudly. The huntsman heard him as he was passing by the house and thought, "How the old woman snores! I'd better see if there's anything the matter with her." Then he went into the room and walked up to the bed and saw the wolf lying there. "At last I find you, you old sinner," said he. "I've been looking for you a long time." And he made up his mind that the wolf had swallowed the grandmother whole, and that she might yet be saved. So he did not fire, but took a pair of shears and began to slit up the wolf's body. When he made a few snips, Little Red Cap appeared, and after a few more snips she jumped out and cried, "Oh dear, how frightened I've been! It's so dark inside the wolf." And then out came the old grandmother, still living and breathing. But Little Red Cap went and quickly fetched some large stones, with which she filled the wolf's body, so that when he waked up and was going to rush away, the stones were so heavy that he sank down and fell dead. They were all three very pleased. The huntsman took off the wolf's skin and carried it home. The grandmother ate the cakes and drank the wine, and held up her head again. And Little Red Cap said to herself that she would never more stray about in the wood alone, but would mind what her mother told her. It must also be related how a few days afterward, when Little Red Cap was again taking cakes to her grandmother, another wolf spoke to her and wanted to tempt her to leave the path. But she was on her guard and went straight on her way and told her grandmother how that the wolf had met her and wished her good day, but had looked so wicked about the eyes that she thought if it had not been on the high road he would have devoured her. "Come," said the grandmother, "we will shut the door so that he may not get in." Soon after the wolf came knocking at the door and calling out, "Open the door, grandmother. I am Little Red Cap, bringing you cakes." But they remained still and did not open the door. After that, the wolf slunk by the house and got at last upon the roof to wait until Little Red Cap should return home in the evening. Then he meant to spring down on her and devour her in the darkness. But the grandmother discovered his plot. Now there stood before the house a great stone trough, and the grandmother said to the child, "Little Red Cap, I was boiling sausages yesterday, so take the bucket and carry away the water they were boiled in, and pour it into the trough." And Little Red Cap did so until the great trough was quite full. When the smell of the sausages reached the nose of the wolf, he snuffed it up, and looked round, and stretched out his neck so far that he lost his balance and began to slip, and he slipped down off the roof, straight into the great trough, and was drowned. Then Little Red Cap went cheerfully home, and came to no harm.
You've been listening to The Myth of Actaeon, The Magic Swan Geese, Why Tortoise's Shell is Not Smooth, and Little Red Cap. Our reader tonight was Gary Hanrahan. Short Happy Life is produced by Gary Hanrahan and was recorded by Chris Batstone and James Bain. Join us again next Monday at 5:30 p.m. for Short Happy Life.